The third door of liberation is emptiness. On one hand, we can talk about or think of emptiness as something very simple. Simple emptiness. So simple, the simplest thing. And we might think of it as being vast, the biggest thing, the vastest thing. Down through the centuries, Buddhists have found great value in this word or concept of emptiness and have, maybe paradoxically, filled it with lots of different meaning, lots of different attributes, ways of understanding it. And I think, you know, probably the great majority of them are inspiring. Some of them border on being metaphysical and philosophically complex. Some of them are presented as being grand statements or grand insights into the very nature of reality itself. That applies to everywhere and everything. In this early teaching of the Buddha that I try to base these teachings on, emptiness is a simple concept. It belongs to the world of simplicity. Hopefully it's possible to talk about it in simple ways. Today the topic is a door of emptiness. It's a door of liberation. And this image of a door, I'm pretty sure whoever came up with this idea, what they had in mind was an open door, not a locked door, closed door, but a door that's way open. And a few centuries later in China, they came up with the idea of the gateless gate, the doorless door, the door that's wide open, that's not even a door, doesn't even have a frame. But anyway, there's something that's open, very open space, an empty space. An open door is an empty space through which we can walk. For someone who is in prison, maybe for decades, when the prison doors are finally opened, that open door is a big deal. Wow. So this appreciation of an absence, an open door is an absence of stuff that's blocking the door, closing the door. And what can be more simple than an absence? Is there an absence to step through? The empty space of a door. It's difficult to grasp it, to grab onto it, to cling to it. It's difficult to have a lot of ideas, attributes to the empty part of the door, the open part, except that it's open, it's without being closed. Most of the attributes are what it's not, or how open it is and easy it is to go through. A closed door has lots of attributes. It can be a very complicated thing. Complicated locks, latches. It can be a beautiful heavy door, silly little flimsy door, all kinds of things. A door could be something you say, this is my door. Or this flimsy door is not my business, not my responsibility. But the open space, is that the absence, that space, mine? Am I the one who has to kind of fix it and paint it and keep it somehow functioning well? Get in there and polish up that emptiness so it's the empty space kind of works better. So as we practice, sooner or later we begin having access, becomes kind of visible to us, have absences, the absence of a tense shoulders. That those tense shoulders finally relaxed and softened, maybe is forgotten, until they get tense again. Oh, wow, that was pretty cool. The absence of feeling responsible for everything in your environment. It's a big deal for someone who has spent decades feeling responsible for everything around them and everyone around them. My duty, my responsibility, it's up to me. That absence of not being the responsible one. When my mother was first put in the memory care home, she was a little bit restless and wanted to go home. But she had no idea what home meant. It was a mythic place for her. And but she had a friend who would call her almost every day in the beginning. And one of the most common things her friend said to her was, You spent a lot of time having to go shopping and driving around and cooking and cleaning and working, and you've done enough of that. Now's your time to rest and to just enjoy. People will cook for you and shop for you, and that settled her. Then she was kind of content for 24 hours. No responsibilities. Emptiness is a door of liberation. And to understand what this emptiness in this regard is about, I think it's also important to appreciate liberation. So that the function of this teaching, the function of what this practice, what it's pointing to, is clearly understood. Because then we can more easily understand what's being talked about. We don't apply or associate the teaching to what is not really the point. So liberation, in its simplest form, is liberation from suffering. And perhaps we can delight that that simple form has no pronoun next to it. Liberation from suffering. Can be our devotion, our dedication in wherever we find suffering, see suffering. Silent self and others in this world. But to know the full possibility of liberation from suffering, how deep and thorough it can be for human beings. It's really important that there are some people who have managed to discover how thoroughly and fully they can be emptied of suffering. If you think it's impossible to clean your room because it's so messy, maybe it's inspiring to see that your neighbor has actually managed to clean their room. Oh, it's possible to clean rooms. Well, then maybe I can do it. For some people to really clean themselves fully of all the sources of suffering, the causes of suffering in themselves, is a phenomenal message, example, modeling for the rest of us. If no one ever did this, would we think it was possible for ourselves to do it? Would we practice that far, that fully? Would we settle in our practice for something short of that? Maybe just coping better in this world. When I first came to San Francisco Zen Center many years ago, that was my first months, weeks there or something, I remember one of the teachers there, made this comment that it's a person that's seen many people come through the Zen Center over the years and been there long enough to see patterns of people coming there as new students. And he said that most people came just to find themselves. And it would take something like 3 to 5 years for them to really find themselves. And the process of that, some people found a renewed connection to their religion of birth. Somehow the spiritual life, the practice of meditation, and that kind of opened and healed and connected them to something that they had been important for them or they missed in their own religion. Some people found themselves and found some confidence in themselves, found what they wanted to do, how they wanted to live their life. And he said that most people who come through Zen Center, that's what they're doing in their first few years. It's the people who stayed more than 5 years, they're the ones who started practicing Buddhism. It was just something he said in passing, but it made a big impression on me. I appreciated from that statement how important it is to find yourself, how important it is to come into one's own. And I think that a big part of Buddhist practice is, in fact, to do that, to come into one's own. And I asked a teacher once, way before I was had any idea of becoming a teacher myself. It wasn't in my mind, but somehow I asked, you know, what is something, I asked something like, you know, when is someone ready to be a teacher? And the person said, when they can stand on their own 2 feet. The Buddha talked about becoming independent in the Dharma. I suspect it means the same thing, that now you know the Dharma for yourself, you know this practice in this way so thoroughly that you don't need books and teachers even, and do you know what the practice is? So it's coming into one's own and developing a certain independence, a certain sense of dignity and value, and even a sense of agency, that we can find our way, we can take care of ourselves, we can, some sense of belonging in this world, or to the Dharma, or to ourselves. There's a lot of this really important work that it just comes with being human being. And Buddhism is not denying this maturation. It actually wants to support it. And in the process of doing that, to understand how much suffering is associated with concerns of me, myself, and mine. If we really want to do the full possibility of liberation, sooner or later, we have to also take a deep, honest look at how much self-preoccupation there can be, how much self-referencing we're caught up in. How much we place ourselves at the center of the drama of our life. And to the degree to which the ways in which doing that brings about distress, anxiety, fragility, contraction, hurt, resentment, envy, hatred, conceit and arrogance, belittling and of others, and worse. So this door of liberation, of emptiness, this liberation is a big deal. It's not a small thing. The end of suffering. So if that's the purpose of going through that door, what is the nature of this door of not-self, the door of emptiness? It's very closely connected to not-self. It's a deep connection, and I use that word choicefully instead of saying insight. I could say a deep insight into not-self, but it's so easy to have a self who has insight. A deep connection, a deep harmony with not-self. Maybe the teachings on not-self is not something to believe or even to understand, but to live it, to be in harmony with. And not self is an open door. Not self is about what is absent that we often fill, an absence usually filled with selves, self-concern, self-preoccupation, self-defense, self-assertion. There can be so much self that is extra, that's not really needed. So much assertion or engagement in self that is actually painful. That's an agitation. That is worse, it's painful. It brings up a lot of pain. So to see the open door, to see the empty space that's left when we don't attribute self to anything. So we can go through that door of liberation. And so this is not about understanding the philosophy of emptiness. It's understanding an absence, seeing an absence. It's not about denying there's a self. It's about letting go of all clinging, craving, grasping to self. The Buddha even pointed out that there's a variation of this, which is grasping to the idea that there is no self. We can get in trouble so easily. So it's the grasping and the clinging. Holding on. And sometimes when we practice, we don't see directly the clinging, the grasping, the holding, but we come and see that we see the fear of letting go of that holding, letting go of the dreams that are all built on the quicksand of an imagined self. I came at the point in my practice when I could see how much I was holding on to ideas of who I had to be, and I'd tried to talk and act in ways to try to convince everyone else I was this imaginary person, this kind of self. And I started seeing how much I was playing this game and trying to not only create a self for myself, but project it for other people to believe it too. And I saw that this wasn't really serving me, it wasn't healthy, it was appropriate to let go of it. And I could see how scared I was to do it. I felt like I was, literally the feeling I had, I was sitting at an abyss, at the edge of an abyss, and I knew what I had to do, but it meant stepping into the abyss. That's how strongly I felt this, you know, wow, I can't do that. I could see, I can't do that. I can't take that step. So what I did was, I was flying to Thailand to dive into this Vipassana practice there in Thailand and Burma. So I decided somehow that I would do a ritual that would mark letting this go. I mean, not that I thought I could let go just through the ritual, but a ritual kind of that would somehow turn the corner, or, you know, help the unconscious understand what was that it needed to happen. So I was flying across the Pacific, and I made crossing the international date line the marking, the point of no return. Maybe it sounds pretty silly, ridiculous, but you know, the way the deep consciousness, our deep mind works, you know, I don't know where that idea came from, but it probably came from that deep mind, so sometimes you need to respect these things. So I was very conscious of, I think they announced, we're crossing. The pilot announced, we're crossing. And I didn't see any noticeable change in me. It's not that easy. But what I did notice, after spending about a year and a half practicing in Asia, on the way back, flying back, I went looking for this thing that I felt like I needed to let go of, and I couldn't find it. I never saw it let go of. But somehow something released during that year and a half of practice. But maybe that ritual was part of that process. So to go back to the image, the metaphor of flowers, if you walk around the property and you find a beautiful flower, chances are any idea you might have that it's my flower does not exist in the flower. The idea that it's my flower, there's no plaque next to the flower that says that this is, you know, your flower, as your name next to it. No public announcement was made. This is so-and-so's flower. That my flower is not found in the flower. The flower is empty of mine. If you come to some idea that you are the flower, that might be nice. Absorb, become one with the flower is kind of a nice idea. Until someone else comes and picks it. Right when you're absorbed in it, when it's just me and the flower, and we're just one. And this is who I really am. I finally discovered, you know, my communing with the fungus. You know, then pluck. And what happens to you then? Wait. I've been killed, destroyed. But this is to be able to look at a flower and not see me, myself and mine, just see a flower. Someone who's a gardener and feels responsible for flowers somewhere else might find walking around another property garden where there's flowers can feel the lightness of not feeling responsible for these flowers. No responsibility here, just I can see the flowers. So these analogies maybe are easy to understand. Very simple, ordinary ways where we're not attributing me, myself, and mine. As the mind gets quieter and stiller, the activity, the mental activity of asserting me, myself, and mine, the construction of self, the ideas we have to define ourselves, and the thoughts we have about how others are affecting this self, and how other people live in relationship to this self, begin to decrease. There's a quieting, a settling. And at some point, it just seems kind of natural to begin appreciating that certain things are not self. We don't take them personally. They're not me. Certain perceptions can occur. And it's clear, this is not who I am. I just heard the bark of the dog. I'm not the bark. I don't feel like I'm the... Wherever my ear is doing hearing the bark, the hearing of the bark, I don't... It's just, I'm not responsible for that sound, and it's not mine to fix, it's not mine to be concerned with, it's not mine to define myself by, and feels pretty good just to hear the bark and not have it play the self game with it. Just there's no self there in that bark. It's just a bark. It, sometimes when the mind is quiet and still, might hear the bark. And an image arises of some random dog that you've seen and that you knew. But it was clear, as this image appears, it's been triggered by the barking dog. But it's like, I didn't decide to make an image of a dog. This wasn't, I didn't choose it and construct it. I didn't plan it out ahead of time. There's something about the appearance of that image that just seems to be so natural and spontaneous in relationship to hearing the barking dog that it's a thought. But there's no sense that that thought defines me, that thought is me, that even this idea that it's my thought is extra. The idea that it's my thought is just piling a thought on top of a thought. And it just feels so simple. And it's kind of freeing to have the image or the thought of a dog to waft up in the mind. Oh, that's not who I am. My wife had, when she was in her 30s, mid-30s, she had temporary for a few months, medically induced menopause. And during that time, she said, I'm having these thoughts I've never had before. But these thoughts are not me. She didn't associate herself with it. She didn't feel responsible for the thoughts. She didn't, you know, she didn't define herself by the thoughts. They were just like these strange thoughts that are bubbling up. And not me. It's possible to be so simple that a pain arises in the body. And not have any self concern about it. There's no self, and we don't attribute a self to the pain. We don't build a self for the pain. It's simply pain. And this was a big lesson for me also in my early years in Zen practice when we... It was kind of, Zen practice was kind of grueling. And there were times where you had to sit with, just have to sit with pain, sometimes for hours without moving with the pain. And the times where you couldn't move for hours and the pain, that was really powerful for me because I learned that if I had self-pity, the pain was worse. If I didn't have self-pity, it was just manageable. So, what to do? What's more important? Have a, you know, well-justified self-pity? or less pain. So I chose less pain. And I could, and I, it was fascinating to watch this movement because the self-pity would creep back in and I had to see it and relax it. And then the pain would relax enough to be manageable. But then the self-pity would come back. So there was this back and forth. But it was such a powerful lesson of what I could add to the pain. And pain is bad enough, but to add all this self to it. And so we sit and practice, and sometimes it's possible to feel and see and understand or relate to this pain without the attribute, the attributing, anything to do with self. Pain, that is like the flower. It's not my pain. It's just pain. If you have a, you know, well-developed logical mind, you'd say, well, that's ridiculous. Of course it's my pain. It's not my neighbor's pain, it's my knee. Why bother with that logic? Why defend this idea that it's my pain? Of course it's yours. It's your knee. Of course, kind of yours. But don't bother with the logic. When you're sitting and getting quiet and calm, when it's clear that you're freer, it's happier, without taking it on as my pain. It can be your pain later. Maybe when you're talking with someone, you know. But when you're sitting alone in meditation, it's actually possible to look at the pain and have any self-concern, self-definition not there. Same thing with emotions. Some people are very closely identified with their emotions. But it's possible to have emotions waft up and feel them and give freedom to them, respect to them, but not be defined by them, not be limited by them, not be judged by them. They're just another form of a flower. Nature makes a lot of flowers. And each emotion is a flower. You can look at the flower, you can let it grow and do its thing without my flower, my anger, my joy. We can start, we sit and get quieter and settled. We can begin appreciating the agitation or even the irritation, the extraness that comes when we start operating me, myself, and mine. And how the absence of that is peaceful. The absence of that is a door or a luxurious bed waiting for you to let rest in. That place, that openness where there's no orientation to think, manufacture, attribute, me, myself, and mine. Is there no self? When the mind is quiet and settled, why would you even bother having such a thought? When the thought itself is kind of a little bit of agitation, why get wrapped up in the philosophy, psychology, ontology, epistemology? Is there not a self? It's one way to get a headache. But just to appreciate being being simple, simply allowing to be yourself as you are, without needing to attribute anything to it. And so it's as practice deepens, there comes a time when no matter what we experience, what we are aware of, what we perceive, we perceive it and it just seems so clear to the mind that whatever that is, it works. Is not self. That's not self. And you can look around and all your experience, nothing, you can find nothing that feels like it qualifies to be the self anymore. Everything becomes flowers in the garden. And that's not something to convince you that it's philosophically, psychologically true. It's not whether it's true. That's not what this game is about. The game is about thinking that way about self is not needed. It's a vacation from thinking that way. It's a phenomenal break, a cessation of thinking along those terms. And so in this experience, in the practice, nothing seen as being me, myself, and mine. And so the tendency of taking things as me, myself, and mine, that tendency, that disposition, that drive, has an opportunity to stop. And if that stops fully enough, it brings suffering to an end. To see or to experience this insight into not-self in such a thorough way is one of the three ways in which the mind can feel the trust, have the trust, the ease, the peacefulness, the openness, that the mind can finally let go of itself. Liberation. So not-self teaching, or the not-self insight, is an insight into an absence. And trust that absence. Value that emptiness, that absence. Let it help you to trust non-clinging, non-grasping, non-desire, the absence of meaning-making and attribution, storytelling. And it turns out we can care for ourselves much better when we're not burdening everything with me, myself, and mine. Turns out life and our lived life rolls along just fine without any attachment to self. If there is an abyss, you have wings. Thank you.